The ball is tipped, and there you are. You're running for your life. You're a shooting star. One shining moment is all on the line. One shining moment.
Welcome back, college basketball fans, to another episode of CBB 365. I'm Adam Hipsky alongside Patrick Dallahan. Joining us today on episode 9 is a double interview, starting out with ESPN college basketball analyst Jimmy Dykes, and then following is Sports Illustrated college basketball writer Pat Forty.
Okay, and joining us today for this episode is ESPN SEC college basketball analyst Jimmy Dykes. Jimmy, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, guys. It's good to be on with you, man. I love your heart for what you're doing at a young age. You're getting a great start on it, and I look forward to visiting with you.
Thank you. So we're just going to get right into it. So looking forward to this upcoming season, if it happens for the SEC, there are, let me count this out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, 6 or 7 teams in the top 20 recruiting classes this year for the SEC. What is that going to do for conference play this year?
Well, I think it's a consistent trend right now in the SEC over the last 3 or 4 years. They've continued to be right there at the top in terms of their overall class that they're bringing into that league. And it's now showing up in 7, 8 bids over the last couple of years. So the talent level, basketball-wise, in the SEC, I think has really increased just in the last 4 or 5 years. Now, a lot of that has to do with the coaches that have been hired. Mm-hmm. A lot of that has to do with the SEC network and the national exposure that the league has gotten. The emphasis that Greg Sankey, the commissioner, has put on basketball in all areas, including scheduling and facility upgrades and all those things. So the SEC guys, they may have lagged behind a little bit on the national scale. When you compare what they've done to football,
yeah,
but that's been corrected, and as a result of that, the talent in that SEC is as good as any league out there.
Jimmy, thank you for joining us today. Looking back on last season, going into Nashville for the SEC tournament, who did you think was going to come out of that tournament and win the SEC tournament?
Well, you have to start with Kentucky. You know, they've won it so many times over the years. You know, Nashville was full of Kentucky fans getting ready for the Wildcats to play on Friday, and they have such a huge advantage in that building in postseason play. And they were playing really well. You know, they just come off a comeback victory at Florida. They were healthy. They were, you know, I think most people would have probably picked Kentucky as a favorite going in. But, you know, that league right now is so good. And, you know, Auburn, I know Auburn was going to be a factor. They just, they have the ability to rise up in March under Bruce Pearl and kind of seize the moment. They like the big stage. You know, although Florida just lost to Kentucky, they were playing well. Tennessee was playing well. Mm-hmm. They'd won, I think, 3 out of the last 4. So it was, it's disappointing that it happened. It was the right call to be made, obviously. Mm-hmm. At the time, we weren't all sure of it. But a major, major disappointment, especially, as you guys know, for those seniors that they missed their last chance for the SEC tournament or the NCAA.
Looking back, staying on the topic of last season, did you think any SEC teams had a legitimate shot at winning March Madness?
Kentucky could have done it. You know, I had them enough to know that they had really everything you want in a team that could win 4 in a row and at least get to the Final Four. Mm-hmm. That their guard play was really explosive. It was young, but man, those 3 kids, Higgins, Quickly especially, really came on. Quickly did at the end. So it's you know, we'll never know. But to answer your question, if there's one team that I think could have gotten to Atlanta, and then you're just 2 wins away, I think it would have been Kentucky, just because of how they were built. They checked most of the boxes.
Out of the core group of Kentucky stars, who do you think is the most NBA ready?
Wow, that's a tough one. And I don't say it because none of them are. I say it because I think they all have a strength. The Maxi kid to me is a wild card because he's so explosive. He's got great size, a great personality. Just a lot of the intangibles he checks off really well. And he just kind of has an NBA game about him, how he plays. Like, he's terrific in the open floor. He's terrific one-on-one. I'm a big Quickley fan just because of his overall game, the seriousness that he brings to it, who he is as a person. There's no one in this draft that is a better character person than Emmanuel Quickley. You know, but then you got to look at a guy like Nick Richards, man. That guy's a full 7-footer. He runs like a deer. You know, defensively, he can impact the game right now. So those Kentucky kids, they find a way to find a niche in the NBA and stick with it, and they do it really well for as young as they are.
Yeah, I was going to say that out of the three or four guys that are going to the draft from Kentucky, it was really more like six or seven. But every single one of them could make an immediate impact on the team that they're drafted to, which is something that you don't really see often except for Kentucky.
Yeah, you're right. But I think it has to do with kind of how Calipari brings those guys along during the year. He coaches them with a pro mentality, a responsibility individually to get better, all those things. And he does a terrific job of communicating that to them.
Obviously, you did a lot of SEC games this year. When you saw Anthony Edwards play, what stood out to you?
His size is just phenomenal for a kid that young, his body to be that developed and have great control over his body for that size. Mm-hmm. I think he plays the game with a joyful spirit. I like that about him. I didn't see him at his best, to be honest with you. I saw him at Auburn and I had him at Kentucky, and he didn't really play well either game. Mm-hmm. But watching him on film, man, he's got some special stuff about him. He can rise up and get his shot off really anytime he wants. That's of great value in the NBA.
Yeah.
He's got the size to do it. He's got the explosiveness to do it. In terms of his tools, his skill, his speed, his size, his strength, all those things, that's not the question.
Yeah.
The question for me is, will he connect the dots? Will he understand how to be a guard that makes his team better? Or will he just be a guard that puts up big numbers but his team loses? And we're not going to know it until he gets in those situations. But he has to connect the dots better, I think, to really be the impactful player that he's very, very capable of being, because he's a special talent.
What I was just about to say is that he has so much potential. And really, for me, the biggest thing he has to work on is just developing a good, like an okay jump shot. Mm-hmm. Like, there needs to be a threat for him to be able to make, like, consistently make open threes. I thought that was something that he needs to work on, because in the Kentucky game this year, I think it was at Kentucky, he was just chucking up threes and they weren't going, and he wasn't playing well because I think it was in the first half, and that's just not him. If he wants to do that, he obviously has to develop a better jump shot. But moving on, what do you think his draft range is? Do you think he'll go top three, top five? Where do you think he'll fall to?
Yeah, I don't think he'll fall out of the top five. There's too much there that NBA scouts are attracted to.
Yeah.
I'm not sure he's going to go one. A lot of people think it's a no-brainer. I don't. I go against the curve right now. I would take Obi Toppin number one. I just think for his size, for the security of what you're going to get in the number one pick this year, I trust what I see in that kid. I trust what he's going to deliver for 10 or 12 years in that league. And those other guys being mentioned towards the top, I think there's a risk factor involved, including Anthony Edwards. And I like the consistency that Obi Toppin brings and his size and how he impacts the game in so many ways. But to answer your question, Edwards could go anywhere from one to five. I don't see him going any lower than five.
When we had Dan Dockich onto the show, he said very similar stuff about Obi Toppin that you did. He said that he likes the way he carries himself, the way he plays on the court, puts him in a very good situation to succeed. And when you have multiple guys that are around college basketball saying that, I feel like that bodes well for that person.
It does. You know, Dan listens to a lot of my interviews, and that's where he gets most of his information. Now, Dan and I...
Don't let him hear that.
Dockich and I think we see the game a lot of times in the same ways. It's interesting, he and I both work on Tuesday nights, so I don't get to see a lot of his games. But when I see a lot of his games, he values a lot of the same things I do. It's probably because, you know, he was spent so much time with Bobby Knight. I spent so much time with Eddie Sutton, and we kind of see the game in similar ways. But I'm a big fan of Obi Toppin now. Especially in this draft, just because of the consistency that kid's going to bring. I, I would take him number one. And if I was in, I get NBA scouts call me all the time. I tell them the same thing. And some of them are kind of taken back by it. Some of them are like, I see the same thing. I just don't know if I can convince my guys to do it.
Staying on the draft prospects, what intrigues you about Isaac Okoro as a draft prospect?
Well, his size is terrific for an all-NBA defensive wing someday. He has the DNA to do it. I think he has the want to do it. He can guard up a position or down a position. That's really valued in that league. I think he's a phenomenal kid, just a phenomenal kid from being around him and everything I've heard about him. I think he works. I think he's got the right people in his ear. Those are all important things. Offensively, he's a straight line driver right now that he's going to have to really work at growing his offensive game, being a consistent shooter, being able to cross people over, make a second move with the ball, and a lot of things like that. But he's a warrior. He competes. He's got good size. He comes out of a great program. Bruce knows how to coach those guys and make them work. So I don't question any of that. If you're taking him right now, you're taking him to impact the game from a defensive standpoint, a big wing, and, you know, just do enough offensively to help you win as well. But he's a phenomenal locker room kid, just a real competitor.
Is he a top 10 guy?
He'll be close. Yeah, he'll be close. I mean, he's a guy, I think it depends on what they're, you know, just kind of what, he's going to have a lot of different takes on his game from what I can gather. So he could go in the top five or he could slide down to 11 or 12 because of the deficiencies that are there. But then you see the upside, the size, all the things I talked about. And he's probably got some wiggle room, you know, four or five spots up or four or five spots down either way right now.
There are so many projected first round picks from the SEC this year. Who are some sleepers that you think will surprise people?
I'm a big fan of Skylar Mays at LSU. Mm-hmm. All conference guard, academic All-American. He's got size. He can handle it. He can shoot it. Makes tough shots. He's a good defender, good rebounder. Like, he's a solid, solid player. And they won a lot of games the last 2 years, and he had the ball in his hands a lot. And I'm a big fan of him right now. That probably doesn't have all the energy and the juice behind his name right now. I know he's being projected somewhere in the top 30 by some, top 40 by others, but I like Skylar Mays on my team if I'm in the NBA.
Staying on LSU, Trendon Watford's a guy that's testing the waters right now, weighing his options, whether just to keep his name in the draft or return back to LSU for another year. Do you see him staying in the draft, or do you think he returns back to LSU?
Yeah, I don't know. I think he's another kid, though, that's got good people around him. I think he'll make a really wise choice. If he were to ask me, I would say he needs to go back another year just from watching him play, watching his body, needs to develop, and I think he'll work at it. He's got a lot of stuff about him for a big guy, man. He can make some plays with the ball and catch it at the top of the key and beat guys one-on-one, can finish. Not a super explosive athlete, but he's not bad. I think he can be a solid defender. If he comes out right now, he's not going to be in that top 20, I don't think, at all. And I think a year from now, he probably could be.
Moving to transfer talk, two big guys just transferred to the SEC. Olivier Saar is one, and Romello White is one, coming from Arizona State to Ole Miss. Do you think if Romello White gets that immediate waiver, do you think Ole Miss is a legitimate top five team in the SEC next year?
Probably top six or top seven, you know, which makes them an NCAA tournament team. And that'd be the second year for Kermit Davis and just year number three, which is terrific. That was a big get for them. That kid's, if nothing else, he's going to rebound at an SEC level. Talking about Romello White, he goes and gets that ball. And that's something that Ole Miss kind of struggled with last year. So I'm pretty close to that Ole Miss program last year. They had a kid setting out that can really score, a guard that's a local kid. From that Oxford area, and Ole Miss will probably start off somewhere in the top 40, I would expect, especially if this kid gets eligible. But they could become a top 25 team by the end of December because Kermit's put together a really nice squad there in Oxford.
And then talking about Olivier Saar, Kentucky brings in the number one recruiting class for next season. How valuable is Olivier Saar's experience to bring to the Wildcats next season?
Yeah, Kentucky is – just even for Calipari, that's such a crazy young team.
Yeah.
Next year. So Saar is going to be very valuable, even if he's not eligible, which I think he will be. But just his maturity, his voice, how he's going to handle himself as an older example for those kids, because I've heard great things about him as a person as well. And if he plays, now all of a sudden Kentucky is, you're looking at them again as, wow, they've got a 7-footer, they got 6'10 guys, they got big wings, they got an explosive point guard, they got a lot of pieces. They're just new, and it'll be a typical Kentucky team where they lose some early. Everybody says this is the worst Kentucky team in the history of the Calipari's era, and then all of a sudden January, February, March, they start winning, and you know, when the bracket comes out, they're one of the teams that we think could get to the Final Four, but SAR is certainly a big part of all that conversation.
Obviously, there's going to be a lot of turnaround next season in the SEC with all these new recruits and transfers. What are some teams that you think are going to go open some eyes for people next year?
I think it's Arkansas. Eric Musselman is, boy, he's done a great job of stashing away players. Had a couple sitting out. He's done a good job this past fall in recruiting and in spring.
And they were very good at the end of the year.
They were very good at the end. And, you know, he's probably going to lose Mason Jones. I don't know about Isaiah Joe for sure, but he's got some talent now. And he's got that Arkansas program. The fan base, I live in Arkansas, the fan base is 100% behind Eric Musselman. Bud Walton Arena has become very difficult now to go in there as an opponent to win. He's playing a style that is hard to play against. He's the real deal. I think Buzz Williams is quickly building Texas A&M into a real problem for a lot of people.
Yep.
For them to win I believe they won 7 games last year in the league. For them to do that when they were picked last, it tells you that the track that he's on, and I'm a big fan of his as well for what he's doing down there. But man, that league is so good. There's so much depth in it right now. You know, Vanderbilt's the team that's kind of at the bottom the last 2 years and has to start catching up. But and that's not easy to do in this league because those, again, like we first talked about, there've been some terrific hires in the SEC over the last 4 or 5 years, and the league's seen the result of it. So. I really appreciate you guys having me on, and you're getting a great start in your career. You'd be a good listener. You're organized. You're sharp. You're on time. Everything's working. You have good questions. And I appreciate you having me on, guys.
Thank you so much for coming on today, Jimmy.
Okay, man.
All right, and joining us today is Sports Illustrated college basketball writer Pat Forty. Did I pronounce it right?
You did. Good work.
All right. Great start.
All right, Pat, thank you for joining us today. Starting next week on June 1st, the NCAA will allow Division I college football and basketball players to begin voluntary team activities on campus. But several schools, including 5 in the ACC, have amended their schedules so that all students are off campus by Thanksgiving. What does this mean for the college basketball calendar? Are we trending towards being able to start on time? Or is there a chance the NCAA is forced to push back the season because of school schedules?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer to that is we don't know, which is the answer to basically every question right now as far as the 2020-21 season. But I think you can draw some inferences. What happens with basketball will depend very heavily on what happens with football. If the football season starts on time, goes well, there's not a ton of health-related problems, I think that gives basketball a very good chance to start on time. The only drawback, or I guess the complication there is they're looking at, you know, again, as you mentioned, getting everybody off campus by Thanksgiving. I've had some people say that that opens up a window to pushing basketball back to start in January. Oh. You know, some other people say, no, it won't affect basketball at all, that, you know, what you're going to be doing, you're just going to be asking the players to be on an empty campus for longer. They already do that every year, but you're going to add 2 or more weeks for a lot of them to what's already a month or so. And at some point, I think the optics are not real good about telling the basketball players, you know, yeah, we want everybody to go home and be safe, but you guys stay here and grind it out so that we got games on TV. That may not be what it comes down to, but that's one of the perceptions out there. So, you know, we're just going to have to see how it plays out. So, you know, the momentum of the last week is good for football, and I think you could infer that that is also good for basketball. But again, we got to see what happens when players start getting on campus and what the health of those players looks like as we get through the summer.
Coming up on 20 D1 sports have been cut by over 10 Division I schools. For now, these are typically only non-revenue sports like track and field or soccer. Do you think there's a chance that smaller D1 schools and D3 and D2 schools will have to make sacrifices to their basketball programs because of this?
I mean, I think everything's on the table. I don't think anything's out of the question at this point. Most people will fight like heck to keep basketball because it is a revenue-producing sport, certainly on the men's side. And if you're going to keep it on the men's, you're definitely going to keep it on the women's as well. You don't want to cut a revenue-producing sport. You don't want to cut a popular sport, a sport that's going to bring people to your campus, put them in the stands, buy tickets, buy concessions, all those things that are going to bring in money and increase the exposure of your university. But like I said, I mean, if the football season goes way wrong, like if we don't have a football season, which is the main revenue generator, all bets are off for everybody everywhere. You know, I still don't think at the top end of the sport, you would see anybody cut college basketball. But at the lower end of Division I, and as you mentioned or alluded to in Division II and Division III, which is less dependent on TV revenue, but still dependent on having revenue, some may just decide to drop athletics. You know, I mean, we've had at least one university just flat out close, the whole school closed. It was, I think, a D3 school.
That's sad.
So that could, you know, that's not out of the question as well. It's, you know, it's a very scary time. If you are an athletic director and you're facing this and trying to figure out how you're going to get through it, I wish you luck, just because it's going to be complicated and scary and you're going to have to make very hard decisions along the way.
Where does the NCAA stand on allowing non-grad transfers to change schools without specific waive permission? Is that something that we could see next season?
Yeah, I think like for Mac McClung and Olivier Saar and everybody else who's trying to transfer right now and hoping they're going to play in 2020, 21, it's not going to happen unless you get a waiver. That's the main news out of the NCAA this past week. So, and I don't know how realistic it is for them to get waivers. We'd have to see what kind of case they could present. But yeah, I think now you'd be looking at transfers immediately eligible if they go that route for the 21-22 season would be the earliest that would probably happen. So I do think it's going to happen. I think at the very least we're going to have a uniform transfer rule, because as it stands now, the crazy thing is there are five sports where you got to sit out and every other sport you can transfer and be eligible right away. So how the NCAA set this up, who knows? Only the NCAA could do this, to have such a completely uneven situation. And I expect them to fix that and probably make everybody have the same rule that the non, quote unquote, non-revenue sports have now, which is immediate eligibility, one-time transfer.
And then going, talking about changes, the NCAA just recently announced that they finalized some changes to their evaluation system, the NET tool, for next season. What changes did they make to the original system that was first used in 2018, and how will that change the way that they rank teams and eventually how NCAA tournament bids are chosen?
Yeah, I think the NET definitely improved from the initial version of it. This last year was, I thought, a little bit more grounded in the metrics that most people look at, and there were fewer outlier teams. I don't know the computations that went into it, but I know that they were working with Google to make sure their analytics were sound and their, you know, logarithms and whatever the heck else they used. You know, that all worked out. I don't know what the tweaks are for this new system either. You know, what exactly they changed, I'm not sure. But, the NET was certainly better than the RPI, and the new NET has been better than the old NET. So I think we're continuing to improve the main metric the NCAA uses.
Talking scandals, one of the smaller scandals that's happened this year was Stephen F. Austin. They got in trouble, some academic problems. What exactly went down at Stephen F. Austin from 2013 to 2019, and why are the teams being punished for something that's pretty much out of their control?
Yeah, a lot of mismanagement went down and a lot of ineptitude, clearly. They certified 82 players as eligible who were not eligible. It's not like, oh, we missed a guy here or we missed a guy there. It's 82 of them. They ran the numbers wrong and they used the wrong academic criteria, basically, to compute who was eligible and not eligible. And the funny thing is, there was a good Dallas Morning News story earlier this week. Basically, they talked to everybody and everybody's passing the buck to somebody else. You know, the AD, well, it was this office, and the office like, that wasn't us. That wasn't me. That's these people over here. So that's, you know, that's how the school, the whole school gets in trouble, because the whole school screwed it up. And so, yeah, big time trouble. I mean, you're just postseason bans for multiple sports. One of the issues with, you know, with academic progress rates is there, it's really not that hard to do, to at least compute it, but you got to make sure your kids are doing the classes. And then for some reason, they couldn't even compute it right. Stephen F. Austin, which had one of the great wins of the 2019-20 season at Duke, and really has been a really good program. They were 28-3 this year, and I think they could have made some noise in the NCAA tournament. And in past years, they've won a game there before. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a big, big hit for them. This is, you know, it will knock them out of the NCAA tournament for 1 year, and it'll leave a lasting mark on them for sure.
We touched on Mac McClung a little bit and the transfer portal earlier. Mac McClung just recently trimmed his list of possible destinations to 7, you know, various from many different conferences. I guess this is a two-part question. Where do you see Mac McClung ending up? And what does this really tell you about the Georgetown program he left behind? Because Georgetown's not in a good place right now. Under Patrick Ewing, obviously haven't had a lot of winning seasons, I believe one out of the past 3 years. So what's going on at Georgetown right now? And why do you think Mac McClung felt the need to transfer?
Those are good questions. I don't know what's going on at Georgetown, but it's a bad look for Patrick Ewing. You know, and I was concerned about that hire to begin with. I mean, he was a great player. And he was an established assistant coach in the NBA, but he hadn't recruited. He hadn't managed young players on a roster. I don't know for sure his coaching style, but his playing style, hard-edged, merciless. And I, you know, if that was his style with today's players, that may just not have gone over very well. Yeah, I mean, he's so far is 15-15, 19-14, 15-17. He is 16 games below 500 in the Big East. It's not very good. And you know, he's going to get another season at least to turn it around. But when you're losing a guy like Mac McClung, who was very important to that team, you know, I really, that hurts him and what he's going to be able to do this next year. And now he's not the only guy to go overboard there. So eventually Georgetown may have to come around and say, Patrick Ewing wasn't the right guy for the job. We haven't gotten to that point yet, but it's an issue. As far as where Mac McClung's going to go, I don't know. Playing style, interestingly enough, Arkansas is one of his teams, and I could see his playing style working in what Eric Musselman does. You know, I think he could be a great just mix master in an open floor setting and a distributor and occasionally a scorer as needed. Steve Forbes would certainly know what to do with him at Wake Forest as well. I'm trying to think who else. Memphis he was involved with, right? Yep. And who else is on his list?
Memphis, Arkansas, Auburn, BYU, Texas Tech, USC, and Wake Forest. Wake Forest with the new coach, Steve Forbes.
Yeah. Forbes would know what to do with him. But So that, I tell you, the intriguing one to me there would be BYU. Mark Pope is a very good coach who's got it going on there. And what they did this last year, they paired TJ Hawes with Yoli Childs, point guard, big. And it was a great combination. And you plug in Mac McClung, who's probably not going to be eligible, but if he is, and you put him with Matt Harms, the transfer from Purdue, maybe you can replicate some of that. So I don't know. You know, I mean, good player would help all those schools for sure, but you know, I don't know where he's going to end up.
Over the course of your career, you've worked with both Jimmer Fredette and Rick Pitino on writing books. How were your experiences with those two, and what were your relationships like with those guys during that process?
There's not much in common between the two of them. That's for sure. They're really, really interesting people. You know, Pitino's one of the most interesting people I've ever covered. Complicated guy, charismatic, incredibly intelligent, very funny, brilliant coach, but also obviously has some major flaws and some major drawbacks and some personal, and then obviously the professional problems that got him fired justifiably at Louisville. There hadn't been many careers like his, just in terms of career arc and just the amount of stuff that has happened. I covered him a bunch, starting when he got to Kentucky, starting his second year from there all the way through Kentucky and all the way through Louisville. I covered him a ton. I live in Louisville. I used to work for the paper. I was the Kentucky beat writer when he was the coach there, so I've been around him a bunch. He's as good a coach and as interesting a coach to be around as anybody I've ever seen. But he's also self-destructive, you know, and he's going to get another chance, but it's at Iona, and he's 67 years old, starting over in New Rochelle, New York. He'll probably do very well, but it's not going to be the same as being at Kentucky or Louisville.
What do you predict he'll be? His career is at Iona. I mean, obviously, there's so much stuff going on right now with Louisville, and then he might even get in trouble with Iona.
Yeah.
Catch back up to him. What do you think could happen there?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's going to sit out a half a season, either it's this season or the next one, because he's going to get penalized by the NCAA, and he's lucky the penalty isn't going to be worse, because he only got a level 2 violation against him instead of a level 1. So he's actually I think he's fortunate. Long term, if he can coach the whole season, Iona's going to win the MAC, the MAAC MAC. He's already lined up a good recruiting class. He will be the best coach in the league immediately. That program is already at the upper end of that league. That league slid a lot. It used to be much better than it is.
Yeah.
But back he will go in there and
good.
He'll dominate that league. I have no doubt about that. Now, you know, dominating that league means you get a 14 seed in the NCAA. So you see what happens there. But still, he will be the best thing to happen to the MAAC in a long time.
All right. Thank you, Pat, for joining us on today's show.
Hey, my pleasure, guys. Good questions. Good show.